Accession number 31411, Real 1.
What I've just said.
How you got into the Navy, that's...
Yes,
tragic.
Well, I come from this part of the world, Bromley, just southeast of here, and I was 14 when the war started, at a fairly crucial stage of your education. I was the local Bromley County School for boys. And we couldn't go to school until they built the air raid shelters. And I spent the first part of the war building air raid shelters and becoming an ARP messenger. And my father thought this isn't very good. He wasn't all that bright at school. He'd be able to do something. He's interested in ships and he wants to be a marine engineer. What are we going to do with him? Well, the training ship Worcester, which I had a family connection with down in Greenhithe, was running. They did do engineering in a very superficial fashion, but it was basically there to train deck officers for the merchant service.
It was a boys' training ship, was it?
Yeah, you went when you were 15. It was a public school, actually. Mm-hmm. I'd say it was the sort of Dartmouth of the merchant service. And there was a convoy up in the Menai Straits. The chaps from the Worcester used to tend to go to the London companies, P&O, Royal Mail, Union Castle, those sort of things. And the convoy chaps more to the Mersey Company, Blue Funnel, etc. Anyway, and the chairman of the Worcester was the chairman of P&O, so it was a pretty close contact, we always used to think. You were entered there as cadet R&R, and when you left, you either decided to stay as an R&R cadet or you didn't. Well, I'd gone there with the intention of doing an engineering apprenticeship when I left. However, all my chums were going away to sea in the merchant service or in the Navy through the R&R. And I had a bit of a rush of blood to the head. And I said, I'll stay here and I'll forget being an engineer. I'll be a deck officer. I've already done 2 years training for it. And joined the R&R. So I stayed in the R&R after I left the Worcester. And the first appointment I had was to Greenwich, Royal Navy College Greenwich, where, as I say, they trade a change of some sailors into gentlemen. And I was just about to go to Greenwich when I had another appointment. Cancel that, go and join HMS Nelson at Scapa Flow. So I thought, all right, that's taking the guilt off the gingerbread. I thought I was going to have a bit of a high life at Greenwich. However, I ended up joining HMS Nelson for Scapa Flow. And I was in her about 6 months, and it terminated just as she went off to the pedestal convoy.
How did you find Nelson? Because she was a battleship, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was a big battleship. 9 16-inch guns and about 12 6-inch guns and about 8 4.7s and, well, a bit of a floating barracks. And, unfortunately, there was only one R&R on board. He was a lieutenant. And I was a bit exposed to... a bit lonely for a while, and I ended up, it was all right, I ran a boat and things like that, and I was midshipman of the watch, but there was over 30 midshipmen, and they were all from Dartmouth, and I was the Worcester, the one R&R Worcester cadet.
Was there a snobbery element?
Yeah, there was. But it was okay, and it was a good experience. I wish to hell I'd never joined the R&R. I wish I'd never gone to the Nelson. In retrospect, I'm very glad I did. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it wasn't all that good. Anyway, after about 6 months, I was taken out of the Nelson and sent to Greenwich. So I did about, I think we did 2 months at Greenwich and a month at Chatham. And then I went to HMS Westminster, which was a V&W class destroyer. And the recital escort force.
How did it feel going to Westminster after Nelson?
That was more my style, really. That was okay, and I can talk to you about the Westminster. I was in there for nearly 3 years. I joined her as a midshipman, and I took the various midshipman's exams, and I was made sub lieutenant. I joined her when I was still 17, and when I was 19 and a half, you could be made a sub lieutenant. And I was made a sub-lieutenant on sort of 19th and a half birthday. And I thought I'd go transferred to another ship, but the navigator left and they just reappointed me as a navigator. So I spent two sort of sessions in a real year. And I saw all the other officers out. And by the time the war ended, I was the sole surviving, well, not surviving, but the last of the officers. I'd seen them all come and go. We'd had two captains and first lieutenants and all sorts of things. And by then, I was very, very familiar with it, and I knew everybody, and I knew my way around it, and I was a navigator, and I was fine, happy.
So you must have joined at the beginning of 43, would that be?
No, end of 43.
End of 43.
End of 42, yeah. Just before Christmas 42. Mm-hmm. And I've got some pictures here about who they are and various people. And we were basically on the East Coast convoys and the Channel convoys, and we used to do patrols off the Dutch coast, and then occasionally we'd be based at Immingham and do partial convoys, and then they go off on sort of offshore patrols off waiting for the E-boats coming out of Almouda and all that sort of thing.
So were they a very experienced crew when you joined? Had they been together for quite a while?
Yes, they had. Well, the ratings in particular, mm-hmm. Yes. The officers when I joined had been since the war began. But as I say, they all left to other things. Someone got killed afterwards, which was a shame. The navigator that I replaced did, and the first lieutenant did. We went through doing convoys. We were involved with D-Day, mm-hmm. in the sense that we knew D-Day was coming. You could see all the sort of Mulberry Harbour and all the funny ships being built.
Can we backtrack to Christmas 42 and
Christmas 42 was, I hadn't been in the ship long. That was I was a bit miserable. We were in Sheerness, got into Sheerness, I think, on Christmas Day. And I did feel a bit miserable. I went ashore on my own, I can remember that. All the other bloke stayed on board. And wandering around Sheerness, ended up in some crummy pub sitting there feeling miserable.
But they were old ships, weren't they?
So old ships.
Was it quite basic inside?
Yeah, it was. We had an action, which we'll talk about in a minute, and that was on its 25th birthday. So the Westminster was built in the beginning of 1918. Mm-hmm. She was involved in escorting the German fleet back to Scapa, she was in the sort of escort, as far as I could. Yes, she was. In the interwar years, it was in the home fleet, laid up into reserve, I suppose, in the mid-30s. And then when war became imminent, she was brought out of reserve and rearmed, and they were called wear class.
Okay.
Now, the V&W destroyers, some were left more or less as built, more modern anti-submarine equipment. Mm-hmm. Others were what they called long range, as they took a boiler out, mm-hmm. and a funnel off, so that they could be, longer range Atlantic and that sort of thing. And the others were the wear class. Now, what they did with the wear class, and the whole of the Riffside escort force was wear class destroyers, they armed them the same as the Hunt class destroyers. Now, in other words, they had two twin 4-inch mm-hmm. Mark 16 two-star A. I don't know that. Why the hell I should, I do. Don't know, but that's actually two twin 4-inch and a TS, and a director, which was the modern armament for a small destroyer. Mm-hmm. Not a fleet destroyer, but a sort of escort destroyer. It meant we were very crowded. So that was what she was, a wear class destroyer. And as I say, she was principally involved. We were based at Rosyth, the Rosyth Escort Force.
How did they solve the overcrowding? Did they put in extra accommodation?
No, sort of hot bunking, really. Yeah. And when you got in harbour, chaps had if you could, they sent them ashore, okay. You know, give them the overnight, the evening, things like that, and it was just blooming crowded, really.
What was
I mean, as a midshipman, I was slept in a hammock, you know, in the officer's flat, and when I got to the exalted position of navigator, I shared a double cabin, which opened straight off the upper deck, you know, around hatchway, and you get full of water sometimes, and on the after bulkhead, the steering engine was I mean, there's a bulkhead and the steering engine was one side of it and my bunk was on the other side of it. So time able to touch the wheel, it nearly shakes right your bunk. And there was a coal fire in the wardroom, I remember. Everything was steam. There was a steam generator. Capstan was steam. She had three boilers. Two Parsons steam turbines, built at Scott's of Greenock, and I was perfectly happy.
Do you know how many men there were on board?
About 90. Mm-hmm. Was it 90? 90. Was it, no, just about 100. I think she was built for 90. We had about 110, just about 100 people. Which is quite a lot, because it's only 300 foot long, and the beam was only about 28 feet, something like that. So she was and fast, still did over 30 knots. One thing about it, this all sounds a bit silly in a way, was it had the nut type, or it's a radar. We used had a 986 and gunnery control radars and surface radars, and the originally, we had what's called an ARL plot, Admiralty Research Laboratories plot, which was a plotting table, mm-hmm. which was mechanically motivated by the ship's course and the ship's revolution.
Like a mechanical computer type.
Then, after that, we had a QH. I think it was called, which was an adapted air navigation, air, like the Pathfinder people mm-hmm. used to have, airborne sort of to position themselves, to give you early type of Decker, an early type of Decker. Also, the radar was an A scan, you know, not a PPI, not a plan position indicator with the, like you see now, like a radar, like a television screen, I think. This was strobes going across, and the aerials were manually and when you get a bearing, you sort of get a bearing of this thing, and then you get the range and stuff.
Are these the ones where you actually had to turn it by hand?
That's right. Yeah. So it was fairly crude radar. Then we did a refit in Henry Robb's in Leith, in I suppose, I don't know, 43 probably, something like that. And they updated the radar. But the unique thing about the radar in the Westminster, I think it was a type 994, was that ship had got knocked about by, in the North Sea, mostly bad weather, I think, and went into Newcastle for some repairs. And sort of the last night, Jolly Jack had a run ashore and came back on board the ship with pawnbroker's balls that he'd pinched. Pawnbroker. And I was a midshipman then. These things got back on board, nobody knew what to do with them, so they were fixed on the frame and put in the after end of the bridge. So these three balls were on the after end of the bridge. Well, when the North Sea convoys used to get into where they terminated off Southend Pier, and you had to get into a single line down the Barrow Deep and coming into the river, and so there'd be one, maybe 50 ships in a line ahead coming in, and occasionally 50 ships line ahead going out, so you'd pass very close. Now the ship I was in, the Westminster, was the second at that stage, was the second leader. The captain was Lieutenant Commander Bowerman, an ex-submariner, DSC, short bloke known as Shorty Bowman, very good captain, bit of a buck martinet, wasn't very fond of reserve officers, but there you are, he got used to us. We got used to him.
Was he one of the submariners that, that declared that they were too old for submarine duty?
No, what happened to him, well, it might be that partly, but he was captain of the first British submarine lost during the war. Mm-hmm. It was actually Miss Oxley. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, the Oxley was patrolling off, as far as I know anyway, I think this is right, the Oxley was patrolling off Norway, or about to take up a patrol off Norway and relieve another ship. Now, there was a cock-up with the recognition signals somehow, and the submarine that Oxley was relieving torpedoed the Oxley and sunk it because they got the recognition wrong. And there was only our captain Bowman and the signalman survived. So that was a bit of a sad story. Now, his predecessor was Lieutenant Commander Ouvry. This is before I joined it. And Ouvry was the brother of the Lieutenant Commander Ouvry who sorted out the magnetic mines.
We have his mine on display on
board
here.
Well, his brother...
Goodness me.
His brother was the captain of the Westminster before Bowman, and Bowman was the captain of the Westminster when I was in it, yeah. Anyway, just to finish this story, the senior officer in the flotilla was HMS Wallace, because the V&Ws, the flotilla leaders, when they were built as fleet destroyers, were all named after Scottish. There was Wallace, Duncan, Stewart, things like that. And HMS Wallace was the senior officer and expected to get all the good treatment. And the first lieutenant of HMS Wallace was HRH Prince Philip of Greece, who's done quite well for himself and is quite well known now as the Duke of Edinburgh. So he was then Lieutenant HRH Prince Philip of Greece, first Lieutenant of Wallace. Well, we were entering London River, or else leaving, I don't know, entering I think, and the Wallace was leading a convoy out. And they were looking at us, and then suddenly a signal came, "What are those funny balls at the back of your bridge?" So we immediately sent a signal back, type 994 radar. And when we got back to Rosyth, there were signals flying over from the Wallace. Why haven't we got, we're the leading ship, why haven't we got the type 994? So they managed to keep this blooming thing up for ages and ages and ages until I think he sent a signal request to the fleet, or the escort force radar officer. There was a lieutenant commander, Patterson, a chap, green stripe bloke in those days, request regilding of the Type 994 aerials, and that sort of was that. But it still is quite sort of quite still known about. And I don't know, perhaps I'll get arrested for this, but when I see that the new Westminster was being built, I wrote to Swan Hunters. No, I don't. No, I went to a naval presentation thing down in Bath, and I said to a chap there, I said, "There's a new Westminster," and he said, "Oh," I was a navigator of the old Westminster, and he said, "Oh, they'd be interested in that." Right to one of the chap's name was, who was standing by the Westminster, new Westminster, at Swan Hunters. So I wrote to him and sent him some of these pictures and things like that. And he wrote back quite a nice letter and said, and I said in my letter, that's it, of course, quite unique with Westminster, because in the same part of the world as Swan Hunters, she had fitted the 994 radar, the only ship in the fleet with it. And I thought he knew all about this and it'd be a joke. Anyway, when they did the glossy commissioning thing for the current Westminster, they say, the previous Westminster, what do they call it, and the history of it, it did this, it did that, and it was the only ship ever to be fitted with a type, so that's still floating about, so I don't know. But there we are, the silly things like that happen, and I came across Admiral Bill, doesn't matter, I was running a little charity thing down in, with a little ship on the Canadian Canal. I was a skipper of this thing. It was a charity, and the chairman of it was an admiral anyway, and he was talking to me one day, and he said diddly, diddly, and I was talking about the Rosyth Escort Force, and he said, oh, I was captain of the Cotsmore, the Hunt class destroyer, and the 21st flotilla at Sheerness. And he said, of course, you were the ship with the type 9943. Oh, this thing's never going to die. There you go. So that's the end of that. The 9948, I meant to tell you that. Now, what else? Another thing, yes, D-Day. We were expecting to sort of, we could see all this D-Day stuff going on.
Can we just talk a little bit about the East Coast convoy?
Yeah. Before. Well, the East Coast convoys that I was involved in were the FS and FN convoys. FS, 4th South, FN, other way back. And the routine was the convoy, this is chiefly what we did anyway. The convoys had come across the Atlantic, round through the Pentland Firth, and the bigger ships would come down and assemble at Methil in the Firth of Forth off May Island, right? And then we'd pick them up in Methil, and I think there was a thing called Duty A, I remember that. We used to have to go down the night before the some of the ships, some of the escorts had to go down the night before to provide an anti-aircraft guard for the ships assembling in them. So we used to go down there from Rosyth, which was our home port. We always used to berth on the destroyer pens in Rosyth, which was HMS Cochrane and that. So you'd sail from the Firth of Forth down St. Abb's Head and down, and there'd be joiners and leavers, there'd be lots of colliers would join from Blyth, Seaham, Newcastle, the coal ports, Middlesbrough.
Were they sort of old and rickety?
I mean, I reckon, really, if the East Coast convoys or the North Sea convoys did nothing, at least other than they kept London going because it provided all the coal for all the power stations. A lot of the colliers that used to join us were flat tops, in other words, they were, so they could go under the bridges, Wandsworth Bridge and things like that, with a retractable funnel. And they were very, very low, and I remember lots of them that were Fulham 1, Fulham 2, like the Sun Tugs, the Fulhams, the Ferranti. There was loads of them, these colliers, and we used to pick all these colliers up.
Was it the same ships time after time?
Yeah. Before we left Rosyth, Methil, there'd be a convoy conference, and the convoy commodore was usually an R&R commander for the East Coast convoys.
They tended to be older, did they, or were they older officers? Or?
Well, the Atlantic convoys had a commodore as commodore, an R&R commodore as commodore. Well, a lot of those were R&R, genuine R&R senior captains, and a lot were admirals who had been reappointed as honorary R&R. They were actually admirals, but they...
So they'd be retired.
They were, yeah, but the other ones were more of a normal sort of age. An awful lot of them were lost, actually. Oddly enough, one of the merchant ships I was in, no names really, so but one of the merchant ships, one of the banana boats I eventually ended up in, the captain had been an East Coast convoy commodore, and our captain, and he never got on. I can remember if we had Captain X or the Commodore, when it listed out, Commodore would be so and so, anything. Oh God, we'll have a wrong trip. And our captain was a fiery little chap, and they really didn't get on. And they used to have running rows on the loud hailer. He was an absolute nightmare. Anyway, years later, I joined a ship in Avonmouth, and this bloke was a captain, and he was, he hadn't improved.
What sort of things did they used to row about? Station keeping and
station stuff. Keeping, speed, every damn thing, everything under the sun. Everything under the sun. But I ran into him again, and I thought, oh no. But there you are. That's what happened. But so, off goes the convoy. We also used to have a lot of midship, well, sort of up to 10,000 pound cargo ships.
So these were the sort of ocean going freighters?
Yeah, coming over. And as they came on stream, lots of sandboats, Liberty ships, the American Liberty ships. And the convoy could be 50 ships. And you'd sail in two columns, and there'd be leavers and joiners right the way down as far as Hull. And as you got south of Hull, where tidal considerations were even worse, it became more extreme, is a general thing, there'd be a certain amount of U-boat activity as far as Flamborough Head, then usually be enemy aircraft activity around the Flamborough Head area for a bit south of that, and then and E-boats. But constantly, and the worst danger really was mining. Mm-hmm. And we used to keep two swept channels which were buoyed. And the mining was the great thing. So you got U-boats at the top, aircraft and E-boats on the way down, and mines all the time. So navigation was pilotage rather. I mean, it didn't take star sights and things like that, but pilotage was key, really.
Was the channel was pretty narrow, was it?
Yeah, I think it was a mile wide. Half a mile wide. Mile and a half a mile. Probably in that book somewhere. But it wasn't very wide. There's not enough two convoys to pass in single line. And then you had to get into signal line, get into signal, double line, all this sort of. But the problem was there was a lot of currents on the East Coast. And on the Atlantic, of course, the ships had followed nose to tail. And the coasters had been used to doing their own thing anyway. And you'd set off in formation, one behind the other. But what they didn't, although they were told, and it's no good keeping a relative bearing. In other words, if you say you're astern of the Franti or something like that, and they'd have very subdued stern light just to keep station on, with a cross current of the tide, you had to keep a compass bearing.
So this was allowing for the ships.
Yeah,
drift.
So they'd be all going along, you know, let's say you've got to keep him bearing north. So the whole thing was, let's say, favourite, should be going like that. But if you go like that, the front one's all right, but the other tail end Charlie is way out in the bloody minefield. So that was the thing we used to have to constantly have to do and beat it into them, and that's probably one of the things we had rows about. It was keeping station on a compass bearing and not on a relative bearing. And of course, that was completely foreign to ships that had come through the, you know, wide oceans. It didn't happen there.
And how many escorts would you have to keep these guys?
Well, I mean, the background of all that, this sort of, I got pretty good at knowledge of the North Sea and the East Coast, and since then, I